Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
So this week's theme, as I shared earlier, is this idea of we are all criminals. Our guest Emily reminds us that criminality is not an us versus them type of situation. And many of us have perhaps committed wrongs that we've gotten away with. These are privately held memories without the sort of public stigma that comes when we don't have a permanent record of our wrongdoing. And perhaps it's that which sort of worth asking, that if we have such a story about ourselves or perhaps even someone that's close to us in our lives, how different would our situation be if you or that loved one was a member of a particular race or class that's overrepresented in the criminal justice system? Have you engaged in any kind of internal reckoning about your past wrongs, even if you're not forced to do so externally by some kind of social institutions? And these are really a set of questions that I find important to reflect upon, because it can really illuminate the various thought patterns of our mind. For example, we know that speeding is against the law. The limits are meant for our safety as well as others. Speeding is one of the leading causes of traffic accidents. Yet so many of us do it, justifying it to ourselves that, oh, it's not a big deal, or I'm a safe driver, or I'm running a little late and I have to get there on time for X, Y, or Z reason. Or perhaps, you know, stealing something small, or a kid stealing a piece of candy, or maybe as an adult in our work life, there's office supplies saying, hey, well, this big bad corporation doesn't pay me enough, or no one's going to get hurt, or no one's going to notice, there's all this oversupply, no one's going to miss it if I take a stapler or X or Y or C. And you have to ask yourself, well, what really ends up happening inside? Are we eroding sort of the limits or the walls of our moral fiber? And until we get to a point where we're actually caught and there's an actual consequence before us. And then what happens when we turn that lens outwardly to those that have been caught? Do we give them the sort of same sort of leeway that we would sometimes often give ourselves? And so I was thinking, Bhavi, maybe you could start us out today with sharing some of your own reflections to help set the framework for our call, and then go ahead and dive right into introducing Emily.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Amit, for setting the ground like that. That was there were some real powerful seeds in what you shared. I had an opportunity to talk to Emily yesterday in preparation for this call, and I was sharing with her this story that I had, you know, happened last week, and I hadn't really thought deeply of it until the things that she surfaced in her work, that her work surfaces. And basically, we had a building inspector come by to take a look at some renovations that we'd completed almost 7 months ago, but because of my husband's illness, we had to delay the inspector coming in. My husband has low immunity right now. But anyway, he finally, you know, came through to do his walkthrough and make sure that everything was to code, and we did get our building inspection. We passed it, but as he was, standing in our living room, we just started talking, and he shared that he grew up, actually he'd lived in this town for 50 plus years, and he grew up three houses down the street from us. And he said, when I was a kid, I put a barrel bomb in the mailbox of your house and watched the thing blow up, and then I ran as fast as I could back to my house. And the woman who lived there, she came running up the street. And she saw me, and she was about to lay into me when this other kid passed by, and I don't know what happened. I just pointed at him, and I told her, he did it. And she believed me for some reason. She gave the kid the lecture of his life. And we were, I don't even know what a barrel bomb is or how you go about making explosives to blow up a mailbox. But it was a funny story, and funny because this kid grew up to become the building inspector in Belmont, and we've heard stories. He is a strict stickler for, the code, and he's a great, he's a great guy. We had a good time, but it was a story that in some ways showed how this, this neighborhood rogue grew up to make good. And that's one, you know, that's kind of, you don't see in that story all the other ways it could have been, you know, had he not lived in a neighborhood where people were able to give him the benefit of the doubt because of his background, because of who his parents were, because of, you know, the community being strong enough to hold something, you know, like that without without thinking the worst immediately. And Emily's story and her work, I think, really surfaces how so many people don't have that second chance, how so many people are judged by that one action, and how, you know, this is a quote that comes up for me a lot in so many different contexts, but it's so true, how we judge ourselves by our intentions and we judge others by their actions, and how quick that judgment is and how much more it defines than we realize. And I think there is so much power and potency to slowing, you know, slowing the momentum down and just taking a look at where we are, how we got here, who we are. And that's the kind of work I think that Emily is doing. And I'm really excited to have her share more about her journey and the different insights that she's come upon in the course of doing the work that she does. And with that, I'm just going to launch into a quick introduction of her. The pleasure is all ours. I want to begin by, you know, looking a little bit at your trajectory. How does a public defender turn into a policy director, turn into a storyteller who somehow, you know, convinces these well-respected, everyday people to come forward with sometimes shameful stories of crimes they were never caught for? It's, you know, it's a pretty remarkable thing when you think about it. But, you know, before we dive into that journey and the before we dive into the present work, I'd love for, you know, for us to get a snapshot of the journey that drew you into the justice system. If you could give us a flavor of Emily Baxter's, like, backstory, you know, where you grew up, what, I don't know, influences in your childhood. Did you always know as a kid that you wanted to work with the law?
Wow, you're taking me way back here. No, I certainly didn't always know that I wanted to work with the law. In fact, for a long time as a child, I just wanted to be a shark. So I guess that in some ways led me down this path. I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I come from a long line of teachers and farmers. So law didn't really kind of come into play anywhere there until after undergrad. I had studied English literature and was working at a coffee shop, caffeinating the collegiates on campus, when I helped an employee there study for the LSAT. She wanted to go to law school. And as I said, I grew up in South Dakota, where there wasn't much to do other than get into trouble, which I may have done a little bit of, and take the LSAT for fun, which unfortunately I did a lot of. Just how boring life is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, when you're taking standardized tests at the Frying Pan or Perkins for fun. And she asked me to help her with this, and I gamely agreed. And through that kind of mentoring, realized just how low the threshold to getting into law school was. And so I took the exam and got into school. And then while in school, in law school, I was thoroughly bit by the criminal bug. I had this incredible opportunity to work as an intern for the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. That's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And there just really fell in love with the work. And so upon graduation, the first criminal related job that was open was an assistant public defender position on the Leech Lake and White Earth Bands of Ojibwe reservations, just north of the city. And I worked there for some time. Absolutely loved it. It was exhilarating. It was exhausting. It was utterly maddening, the deep injustices that permeated nearly every aspect of life for my clients. all of whom were Native American, and all of whom were poor. After a while, it took its toll, and I left. I left public defense, and I did so with a kind of naivete that I think only comes when you're in your 20s. I was absolutely certain that I could change the law, and that if I could change the law, I could change the realities for my clients, my former clients. And so I started working as a lobbyist, working in criminal justice reform at the Council on Crime and Justice in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we worked on some really cool issues like banning the box, removing the criminal records inquiry from the initial job application, so that one with a criminal record would have the opportunity to get their foot in the door before being denied because of their history. We also expanded expungement law, so people with more serious records other than just kind of negligible records would have the opportunity to ostensibly, you know, get a clean slate, although that's not a reality in today's information age. But nevertheless, they would have a better shot at moving forward. But I found that work just wasn't enough. Even when you changed the law, you weren't changing the hearts and minds of people who were engaging with that law. So those victories, at least for me, seemed to fall short of the greater change that needed to happen. So during this time, I can tell you a little, and a relatively minor one at that, I let out this laugh. Even if the court doesn't expunge your record, it's not like your life is over. And with that, he started to cry. You see, earlier that day, he told me, he had contemplated taking his own life. What was just a theft to me, to Anthony, was a lost job. It was missed housing payments. It was skipped meals. It was door after door slammed in his face. It was the loss of respect from his friends and family, the loss of a sense of self, and the loss of hope. With that, he dissolved years of this kind of shellacked jading that had happened, right? I had become so cynical to the entire process that I just didn't see why anybody would be worried about a minor offense when, in fact, that minor offense was the thing that had been defining him since he picked up that record. And as he was telling me this, I thought back to those conversations with the decision makers across the state, the people who said, once a criminal, always a criminal. And I thought, how many times had I taken something that wasn't mine? Hmm. How many times had I gotten away with committing crimes? And what did my race, what role does my race, my class, my era and geography and gender have to do with the fact that I got away with it? And what would life be like if I didn't have the luxury to forget? So I started asking other people that same question. What if you had the luxury to forget? And picked up a camera and a recorder, hopped in my hatchback, and drove across the state, now all across the United States, interviewing people in places where they would feel comfortable enough to disclose to me something that they've otherwise had that luxury to never tell. Then I take photographs of the individuals, maybe of their hands or a picture of their cat or the contents of their fridge, something that shows an individuality and a personality, but of course without identity. And I then placed the first, I believe, 80 of those stories with those mugshots, if you will, online at weareallcriminals.org. You can see the collection of the third of the stories that I've collected now.
It's amazing. I mean, just thinking about the origins of this project, this effort, you know, that it all came to a head with this one person sort of, whose experience you vividly felt in that moment, and what that led to. To me, you know, that you jumped from that moment of insight into this exploration of people's stories as a way of triggering first understanding empathy and then eventually change. I think that's a powerful, you know, insight that you stumbled into, and that, I mean, I'm just trying to imagine how you went about doing it. You can have, like, did you, I don't know, were you stopping strangers in the street or like asking their stories? Like, how did this organize and what did it look like in those, you know, as you began to collect these stories? I imagine that it wasn't like you knew ahead of time where you were going with this and what it, but it was as much an exploration and as much about, you know, kind of learning as it was about, you know, kind of effecting an immediate change. It's a much more, it's a longer game than that you're in, I feel like, and that at every step you're continuing to inform your own understanding of the problem and where the solution lies is, I think, what makes it so so resilient in a way. But I'd love to just kind of, you know, have you share a little bit more about that, the initial phase of this, because now it's been a few years, and I imagine there's the process, and it's all, you know, much more structured than it was before. But what were those first encounters like? And
it's like a parade of failures for me. Also, you know, it was really interesting. The way that I first got the way that I got the first round of stories was through a flyer. I drew up a flyer that said, "We are all criminals. One of you has the luxury to forget," and I left my contact information. I then sent that through our social service network when I was still working at the nonprofit. But I asked that network not to respond because I didn't want to hear from people that I already knew. Instead, I asked them to forward it on to their friends, to their coffee clubs, their colleges, their church groups, and so that I could talk to people who were three or four or five times removed from me. And to my unending surprise, the phone actually started to ring. And that was when I thought, oh my gosh, I better buy a camera. I need to get a recorder. I was not prepared for people to actually engage. And it snowballed from there. It's really been this incredible, incredible experience for me to have gone from a belief that people just didn't understand or that people wouldn't want to participate to recognizing the incredible community that can be recognized, if not created, just by listening, by asking the question, and then by listening to the response. And that, again, didn't quite come so quickly, and Lord knows I probably still have a lot to learn in the journey. But the first round of interviews that I did, I was very heavy-handed in the questioning. I think I still was working in kind of litigation form, and I was steering the conversation to kind of to draw out the quotes that I wanted. I felt like I had to lead people down the path in order to get the stories that I thought would be most impactful. And then as I was trying to transcribe these interviews and listening to the recording, it was just hours, Poppy, hours of listening to myself talk. There are few things as torturous, I think, as having to listen to yourself talk over what could be a brilliant story. And so then through that, I learned to just shut up, really, to take myself out, to just be the receiver of these stories. But unfortunately, I took myself a little too far out. I became very clinical. I started asking people, I would, you know, turn on the recorder, ask them some simple question like, "So, what do you have to tell me?" And then they would tell me their story. I would respond perhaps with a few facial expressions, but otherwise not say anything because I didn't want to have to hear myself later on the recording. And then I'd have them sign a waiver and say thank you very much and turn the recorder off, and I was done. What happened following that, in the weeks after those interviews, I started getting phone calls and emails from people who had participated, people who said that they'd started drinking again or stopped going into work or couldn't get out of bed or were in some other way very just harmed by that interview. And I realized that what was happening to these participants was echoing what had happened to my clients when they picked up a criminal record. My clients, they had their development arrested, right? They were tethered to this moment in time that would forever define them, as fresh, a decade as it was from a day. And for the individuals that I was interviewing, the same thing happened. Suddenly, I was tethering them back to that moment, and they, even though there was only one other person who knew their story, that one other person being me, and I certainly wasn't publishing their faces or their names or any real identifying information, it was still just enough to know that there was one other person out there who held that story. They regressed. It was like a development regression where suddenly they were back in that moment. And so now in the third round of interviews, the kind of structure that I'm doing now is, again, not saying much, so I don't have to listen to myself. But at the end of our interview, say if it's an hour-long interview, the last 20 minutes, I ask the people to tell me about what they're doing today for the rest of the day. What else is on your docket? Or tell me about your typical Tuesday, or tell me about school or work or your kids or your church, something that helps bring them back to the present moment and helps kind of repair their psyche to, identifying with who they are now, right, or how they prefer to have the world know them as a mother or as a son or as a doctor or a police officer or a volunteer or coach, whatever it is, but so that people are not stuck in that moment in the past that I drew them back to. Now, that doesn't have to happen with everybody because not all stories are stories that bring great shame to people, right? I mean, some are just cathartic. Some are stories of drunken college nights. Some are oh, my gosh, I did this. Kind of like your inspector, right? When he was a kid, he did this thing. My guess is that he didn't go home and feel like, what have I done with my life? And, but rather that this what a crazy, thing that I did when I was a kid. So he probably doesn't need someone to repair him. But that's not the case with everybody. So it's been a journey for me in learning how to both elicit these stories in a very authentic way, and to honor the process and to honor that the voice of the participants, but then also to recognize how much I'm taking from people when I ask them to disclose something that is so intensely personal, and honoring that by giving back to them their present self, I guess. And does that make sense?
It does. And I've been amazed looking at the site and reading some of these stories, just a cross-section. It's, you're talking to attorneys, you're talking to bank tellers, you're talking to, doctors. It's across, it's across the board. And having these people reflect on, it's almost like, reflect on what didn't define them, what didn't define their stories, making, just that, shining a light on that part of their story that didn't get amplified, and thank goodness it didn't. But I think that just sometimes we forget how much grace there is, you know, or whatever the word you want to use, but how much, you know, there's this kind of a conspiracy of goodness in some sense that allows us to stand where we are with the privileges that we have that are not really our doing, or it's almost like in spite of our feelings and our flaws, we've been given that second chance, you know, a million times over. And there's something very, very humbling about that. And I wonder if you've had a chance in the course of doing these interviews to ever kind of, do you ever get it? I imagine many of the ripples, you know, happen invisibly and that you won't, there's actually no way of capturing or quantifying them. But do you ever see or hear about how it triggers a change in maybe the way someone decides to hire, or someone, you know, looks at a student? Or do you ever hear that part of the story come back to you?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the first story that came to mind when you asked the question, I'll tell you a bit about it. Recall that I said I had sent flyers out to the social service network and asked the network to forward it on. That's what happened to this particular gent. He received the flyer after it had been handed, passed on by several other people. So he was three or four or five times removed. This guy had no context for the overall conversation of mass criminalization, much less the project of We Are All Criminals. And so he said when he got this flyer, he was ticked off. He couldn't believe that there was some punk in the cities who was calling him a criminal just because he was a member of the human race. So he said that for the first 3 weeks, he would pick up his phone and dial all but my last digit, wanting to call me up and ream me out. When he finally did punch that last number, he did so not to complain, but to participate. You see, he recalled that he used to run drugs across Lake Superior. How do you forget something like that? You know, you forget something like that when you think of drug trafficking as something that happens between strangers in darkened alleyways, not something that happens between college friends. So what had happened was his freshman year, he left his hometown and went to a private school across the lake. His sophomore year, he transferred back to his hometown and moved in with some of his old college friends, who it turns out were no longer just smoking dope, now they were selling it. And this guy was then the ideal conduit to the untapped market across those stormy waters, because he knew who the potential smokers were. He knew who the potential narcs were. And so they trained him in on phones, he said. He would often handle the communication. Sometimes he would run the drugs. He would take the money. He asked me after all of this if I thought that anything he did rose to the level of something criminal. Yes. It most definitely rose to the level of something criminal. On state level, on federal level, not just criminal, we're talking felonious. This is something that, you know, you could have, that could have completely changed the trajectory of your life had you been caught. And with that, he just started to unravel. He started thinking, okay, hold on. So if I would have been caught, I wouldn't have graduated college. If I wouldn't have graduated college, I wouldn't have gotten that first internship where I met my wife. If I wouldn't have met my wife, I wouldn't now have my two sons. Okay, he said, but let's say that by some cosmic confluence, I did meet my wife. I still did have my two sons. What kind of father would I be? He said, for example, every year he fills out an application to volunteer with his son's hockey league team. And every year it asks the question, have you ever been convicted of, and lists 10 offenses. And every year he blithely checks, no, 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 no. He said, if they were to ask, have you ever committed any of the following, he doesn't know how he would respond. And if they asked, have you, and if he had been caught, he said, I don't know what I would do. He said, I would have three options. Number one, I could lie. Okay, this is the gent that nearly got an ulcer from a flyer. He is not about to lie on the application because if somebody Googled him, they would find his record, and he just couldn't do that. So, okay, that was off the table. Can't lie. Number two, he said, he could check yes, we'll explain. Now, this man has been a business owner, and for the last 10 years on his initial job application, he asked, have you ever been convicted of an offense? And every time that box came back checked in the affirmative, he would chuck it because he said he didn't want to work with a criminal. He said even more than that, even if he did try to explain, he knows how parents work. And the stigma wouldn't just attach to him, but it would run down to his sons, and he wouldn't do anything that could potentially harm them. So he said he would have one option left, option number three. He could just not respond. He could just take himself out. Poppy, I can't tell you how many people I've worked with over the years who have just stopped responding, who have just taken themselves out, because you can only get that door slammed in your face so many times before you just say, enough. Now, I'm not saying that people with criminal records can't be incredible fathers. They most definitely can. Mothers, too, sisters, mentors, leaders. What I am saying is that for the 75% of us who don't carry a criminal record, we're creating these barriers that lock out the 25% that do, and sometimes we don't even realize we're doing it. Now, this gent, after I interviewed him, after he shared his story with me, he then contacted me later to tell me that he had removed that question from his job application and that he was now hiring people with criminal records.
One example,
there was another woman who, in the course of her story, that's how I found out that the project had affected her. She married quite young, and before she even said, I do, she said she knew it was a mistake. But they got hitched, and before long, he became abusive. And she said that she did what most kids in their early 20s do when they want to be out of their own bodies. She would drink and drink into oblivion. And after drinking, she would drive home. She had a million excuses for driving home, right? That she, that he wanted the car home at night, that, she was a better driver when she was drunk, that she couldn't afford a taxi home, that she needed the car the next morning, whatever it was. She had a million of these excuses. After some time passed, she got a divorce, and she turned her life around. She went into law enforcement, met her now husband on the force, and really just found a new life, a new chapter, maybe even a new book, you know? Mm-hmm. It was a few years ago then that everything came to a halt. She and her husband were driving back from a law enforcement benefit when a car on the highway crossed over the median and going 60 miles per hour slammed into them. She said it was this explosion of airbags and engine and bone. Her husband was airlifted to the nearest hospital with a 50% chance of survival, and even now, years later, still is crippled in pain. She said that she herself was, got serious nerve damage because of this. And the driver, the man who blew, I think it was like a .26, he was terribly drunk, the 20-some-year-old driver who crossed the median and slammed into them walked away without a scrape. She said that in the years following that, she was consumed by anger. She hated this man. She said that if she could have found him, she doesn't know what she would have done. And so she said, thank God I never did locate him. Mm-hmm. She stopped eating. She could hardly work. She was overcome with this incredible hatred toward this man. And then she heard about this project, We're All Criminals. And she didn't engage with it willingly at first. But after some time, she said she she kind of opened herself up to the possibility that she was a criminal too. And through that then realized that that man, the one who had crossed the median and slammed into her, that could have easily been her 100 or 1,000 times over before. And she said that she's not able to fully forgive him yet, but that she's working toward that. And that as a law enforcement officer, what greater thing can come from this than empathy? And from understanding that there aren't two distinct categories of people, us and them, clean and criminal. But instead, to recognize that common, not just the common criminality that we all share, but the common humanity. And to allow those opportunities for true interaction with one another, for second chances, but for first chances too.
That's such a powerful story, and it just gives me a glimpse at kind of what a privilege your job is, in some sense.
You know, yeah.
To be able to, and how it demands a standard of empathy. I think that I don't know. You have to keep that in you, I imagine, really sharp, and because the last thing you want to be doing is going into these situations and these interactions with judgment. I don't imagine it's possible to do the work that you do with that. You just have to bring your deepest compassion to the table, and that's what allows for these types of transformations and insights to unfold. It's quite stunning.
I should mention though, Pavi, to be honest, I have to constantly relearn that, right? Because I'm not even aware of my own prejudices half the time. I'll sit down across from somebody and they'll start telling me a story and it's not where I thought it was going. And I realize that I am just as guilty of constantly bringing, you know, that lens, right, that clouded lens that we all carry. Yeah. It's a daily exercise to recognize that I'm doing it and to with everything I can wipe that clean so that I can see that true person.
And I think that's the challenge, and actually that's the real work in a sense, right? Because it's exactly that. It's trying to examine the very lens with which we examine the world, and
sure.
You know, we assume, we carry so many assumptions about, you know, we're good people the way we look. We just assume that we have. I don't know, that the way we're experiencing things is accurate. The way that we're viewing things is reality as it is. And it can be quite far removed from that without us, you know, without us knowing it. And I remember a few years ago we had a guest on this call, Jacques Verdun. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work. He works in prisons and very powerful program called GRIP, Guiding Rage into Power. Mm-hmm. And he's often working with men who are in for life. And one of the exercises that he does in, you know, in the circle of these people who've been convicted for, you know, oftentimes very horrendous crimes, he'll make a column on a board of the number of years that they're each in for. You know, and that ends up to, like, when you total it up, it's like several hundred years.
Yeah.
And on the other side, he does a column of how long did that mind moment last in which you committed
it? Oh, wow.
You know, and sometimes it's like a 3-second mind moment, right, that led to whatever, a lifetime in prison. And when you add up that column, it's less than an hour of time most of the time, you know, and then he asked us, when he was talking to a group of us, he said, you know, how many of us can say we've never lost control of our mind for, you know, minutes at a time or a few seconds at a time? And it stops you in your tracks, you know, because we all know just how out of control we felt at different times. And we know just how not ourselves we felt at different times. And, you know, what... just the humanness of that condition and the fact that despite ourselves, we've managed to come this far along is because of the kindness, because of the compassion, because of the, you know, these second chances that we've been extended without even, you know, realizing it. And I think just having that conversation, asking that question, hearing these stories, I think it really does. I think that there's a slow working of transformation that it, you know, it sparks. And I'd love to hear kind of you unpack that a little bit, and maybe these stories are so fabulous, to share one of your own experiences of that kind of, you know, that shift, that understanding of, like, you know, you thought you might, of being able to call yourself out on your own, you know, judgment that you didn't know you were holding at that time, or a story that took a, you know, a turn that you didn't see coming, and that taught
you.
Wow,
there's so many. There are so many that fall within that. You know, one of the first ones I was thinking of was a gentleman who he's an academic, a very kind and calm and brilliant academic that I met, and I wondered what story he had for me that would fit within the project, you know. And every now and then I get people who say, you know, minor things that are still helpful. Like I stole a sandwich, or, you know, I used to pad my tips with bills from the till, or I downloaded music unlawfully. I you know, drank underage, whatever it was, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought that he must have something along these lines, right? Maybe he didn't return a library book or something.
Yeah.
And instead, he told me that when he grew up, he lived in a rough neighborhood. And his family moved to an even rougher neighborhood when he was 15 years old. He said that he found himself beaten and mugged several times within the first few weeks, and that before long he realized that when he surrounded himself with a certain group of guys, the beating stopped. So he said he did what perhaps many logical 15-year-olds would do, and he joined the gang. That didn't come for free, and the price was exacted one Saturday afternoon when he was told that if he didn't pick up a lead pipe and beat a child that looked a lot like him, another 15-year-old boy from a rival gang, that he himself would be beaten. He said that he made the decision that day that he's regretted ever since, and that, in fact, at least once a month in the middle of the night, he wakes up screaming, thinking that it's all happening again. He picked up that pipe and he hit that child. If he had been caught, he would have been certified to stand trial as an adult. He would have been convicted. Once convicted, he would have entered the system and eventually gone into prison and then come out and then gone back in and come back out. That kind of revolving door that happens to millions of Americans, right? He wasn't caught. He graduated from high school. He got a scholarship to go to college, where he said for the first time in his life he was able to read a paragraph. He could complete a math problem because for the first time in his life he wasn't constantly checking over his shoulder to see what was coming next. He could concentrate. He was safe. His grades skyrocketed. He went on to graduate school and now has a PhD in biophysics. I would have never guessed that this man carried so much with him, right? I would have never guessed that he would have picked up that pipe. I would have never guessed that he had grown up in poverty. But he seemed as privileged as most of the other academics I know. And it helped further validate, you know, two things. You know, one, you really cannot begin to understand another story unless you listen, unless you ask and listen. And two, that there are so many people across the United States whose futures are foreclosed before their brains are even fully developed. Kids who are born into situations and environments that are wholly different from what I experienced. And they're robbed of a future before they can even fully enjoy the present. And so I think that really, that took me back. There were others too. There was one woman, I learned to ask different questions because I, you know, not everybody identifies their criminal history as criminal. There was one woman that, you know, when I asked her what she had gotten away with, she said, "Oh, I've got something of a rap sheet that for which I was never caught." And she listed off fairly common things like drug use and drug paraphernalia and driving while buzzed and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then I asked her if there was anything that was that she did that wasn't criminal, but just something that she felt kind of bad about. Mm-hmm. And she said that when she was 18 years old, it was senior skip day at high school, she tipped over a porta potty with somebody inside. It was a girl that she didn't really care for. And she said that, you know, the excrement went all over this girl and that she felt horrible about it. This is decades ago and she still feels horrible about it. She's a social worker now. You know, she's dedicated her life to helping people, but she holds this memory. And so I told her, you know, that's a felony, right? You know, assault with bodily fluids, you know, I mean, among many other things. And yeah. She would have been barred from her profession, but she didn't realize it. But there again, you know, I wasn't expecting that kind of story from her. And I've heard that time and again from people. And then there are, you know, deeper conversations that I've had with people that have revealed my own prejudices back to me and have made me more aware of those, not just in the project, but in other instances in my life where I have forgotten that I'm still carrying that lens with me. I was in Alaska last summer and interviewing people who were part of the Yupik Nation, so people in Western Alaska. And I realized that I was, again, bringing all of these prejudices with me without even recognizing that I was doing it, and I was failing to really honor people's full experiences and stories because I was just leaping to the end. I thought I knew what the conclusion was.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that I do a lot, unfortunately. So part of the project is a constant reminder to myself to just be quiet and listen. I realize now that I've been talking at you for an entire hour, and so there's an irony.
No. That's what you were invited here to do. Before we open up to the questions from listeners, I did want to have you speak a little bit about the, you know, the almost like the flip side project that you have going that we haven't touched upon yet, but I think it's also there's a lot there. Just as this We Are All Criminals project kind of has, you know, everyday people without criminal records kind of considering, you know, their own past and looking at corners that they may have been ignoring. You have another project called More Than My Mugshot,
that's exactly it, right. So there I interview people who have been caught, but the focus isn't on their criminal history, and it's not really even on how that record has affected them moving forward. Instead, what we focus on is are the positives by which they define themselves. What's more relevant to a background check than your 8-year-old record or your 10-year-old record or your 2-year-old record? What is it that you could bring to the table if you were just allowed in the front door? And so thinking back to Anthony, for example, the gent that I met in that horrid basement in the government center in Minneapolis, Anthony is defined by his criminal record, right? He's a thief. But he's truly a father. He's a caregiver, a nurse, a speaker of six languages, a survivor of genocide, a volunteer coach, and an avid reader. And yet you would know none of that if all you saw him as was a criminal. My hope is that through this project, we can see people not defined by their worst moments, but by their true worth. You know, give Anthony that luxury to forget and the opportunity to be forgiven, to not be tethered to his past, but wholly able to live in the present and to dream of a future. So that's...
We actually had a comment that came in online from Priya, who's listening in from Chennai in India. And she asks, you know, have you asked people who are part of the legal or enforcement system some of these very same questions? Have they done anything that they felt about and gotten away with it that could have been considered criminal? And really, what did they have to say, or had it, did going through that conversation with you, did it create a shift in their work or in the system itself? I know you had shared the one about the young lady who eventually went into law enforcement, but if there was anything else perhaps that you had a story to share.
Yeah, it's a funny story. So I was giving a lecture, a CLE, a continuing legal education class, and it was near the Capitol. And so there were policymakers that were coming in for their free CLE credit. And this one gentleman came in, crossed the just in front of the stage and sat down in the chair furthest from the door. This is in Minnesota, by the way, which is key to understanding that when I began to flash the PowerPoint that said, we are all criminals, you could tell that this guy was in the wrong room. He did not want to be there. But he's in Minnesota, so he's not going to get up and leave, right? I mean, he's got to be polite. And so he instead just shot me daggers for the entirety of the half an hour or hour talk. You know, he was clearly uncomfortable, clearly didn't agree with what I was talking about. And I kept my eye on him because at the end of the talk, I wanted to engage with him personally, just one-on-one, because I think that the notion that we've all committed crimes is not a novel one by any means, and it's really not that complicated. Once you understand just how overbroad our criminal justice system is, you really do understand that you cannot live for any appreciable amount of time in this country without violating multiple laws. And so after the talk, I made my way over to him, but he saw me coming and beelined it out the door. And so I was starting to walk after him when two other legislators stopped me and said, you know, he's a lost cause. We've tried to engage with him. Don't worry about it. Yeah. And I felt defeated. Like, how can I get to this man, right? Mm-hmm. 2 weeks go by. And in the local newspaper, there's an op-ed written from this legislator, and it says, we are all criminals. And he says that we need to seriously reconsider our criminal justice system and the policies that perpetually punish people. And it was the most incredible op-ed. and from there then, you know, he's supported second chances, he's co-authored bills, this guy is amazing. And I'd like to think that this project had something to do with that transformation. So yes, I have reached out to the very people who are penning the laws, and there has been good movement.
Wonderful. And thank you to Priya for your question. I'm going to go to one of our callers. And again, for those of you on the phone, you can push *6 and you can ask Emily a question. Just let us know your name and where you're calling in from, and then ask your question.
Hi, this is Audrey calling in from Berkeley, California. And it's been so insightful to listen to your story. Thank you so much. My question was actually related to how earlier on you mentioned that when you got into criminal law and you were kind of, you know, the winning policies or changing policies didn't really influence you and didn't change the hearts and minds of people the way that you thought, so it felt incomplete. And I'm wondering now, after you've kind of engaged in this project, has that, you know, and engage with the mind and heart of people and yourself, has that influenced the way that you view or work with law now or policy now? Does that make sense?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. Thanks, Audrey. I think that it has. I do. I've realized that, first of all, I should say that there are advocates and activists who rise every day to do amazing work and who change the laws and who do change the hearts and minds of many people. And I respect them so much. The problem was is that it just wasn't fulfilling for me. I didn't feel like I was doing the work that I could do well. And so I used to, both as an attorney and as a lobbyist and an educator, I used to focus so much on statistics and statutes, right? Through this project, I've really come to understand the importance and the poignancy of stories. And so this project then kind of exists at that intersection of statutes and statistics and stories. And through that, I've changed the way that I've interacted with policymakers by bringing stories forward first and then backing those stories up with the facts and figures that ground it in the necessity and urgency for change. But my focus is back on people, I think, more than it had been. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. We have another individual that wrote in, that's writing in from Illinois and wanted to know, you know, of all the rights that are taken from felons, why is voting one of them? And, you know, if, you know, I guess sort of how is that sort of come up in the stories that you've come across or the reflections, whether it's with individuals or on for people in law enforcement or policy?
Yeah, that's a great question. In part because the law is different throughout the United States. There are some jurisdictions where individuals never lose their right to vote. And then there are some where they'll lose the right to vote permanently after a felony conviction. The justification for that is old. Right? It's the idea of social exclusion. It's the idea of a civil death, that you have forfeited your right to weigh in on community matters because you have betrayed the community. You know, that was, in many states, those laws were put into policy back when there were only a handful of felonies on the books and only a handful of people who were convicted of those felonies. Now you're talking about millions of people nationwide that have lost the right to vote, who can no longer engage, not just in these huge elections, you know, elections that would have turned out differently, like the Bush v. Gore election, for example. There are criminologists and sociologists that say that if the voting laws would have been different in Florida, we would have had a starkly different outcome to that particular presidential election. But there are also local elections, right? School boards and city council members, park boards that have a great impact on people's everyday lives, and yet they're not able to cast a ballot because of this, you know, scarlet letter, mark of Cain that they carry along with them. And so there has been some really awesome research. I believe it's by Dr. Christopher Eugen from the University of Minnesota, who looks at voters in the Pacific Northwest. And there were probationers. If I recall this correctly, he had two groups of probationers, some who were allowed to vote and others that were not. And for the group that was allowed to vote, they had a reduced recidivism rate. They were not engaging in crime. They saw themselves as contributors to their community rather than as detractors to society. And so there's some pretty cool just anecdotal research as well as this broader academic, quantitative research that shows just how beneficial that rights restoration is, that re-enfranchisement is for people.
You've been working on this for a number of years now. Obviously, it's at the forefront of your mind. Even when you're interviewing folks, you said earlier that you have to constantly remind yourself not to jump to one thing or another. Story ends up in a different place. So when you speak about that lens, you know, how do you wipe it clean? I mean, I'm sure some people meditate. Some people have a daily reflection practice. I'm curious, how do you wipe your own lens, or how you recommend that so for others, so that this type of reflection kind of comes up in these types of moments?
I wish that I
softball questions, right?
No, that one actually isn't. I wish that it were. I was telling my friend Rupal that the only time I've been able to successfully meditate is when people are talking about sports around me, because I can tune it out so well that I feel like I actually hit this other plane. It's the only time I've been able to do it. I need to work on my meditation practice for sure. I run. I think that's part of it. Just running and listening to music to get a lot of this out and to kind of connect to the earth in a way that you don't when you're just sitting at your computer, which I spend a lot of time doing. I think that kind of, you know, pounding of the pavement helps me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wanted to also just talk a little bit more about this new project that you've dived into that Pavi brought up, which is I'm really glad, because it just seems like such an intriguing project. And I was hoping you could say, you know, just tell us about, you know, how you're actually coming across some of these individuals, because I'm doubting that there's a flyer that is going up at prisons unless I'm wrong.
Actually, I have been reaching out to prisons, but that isn't just the population that I'm seeking to engage. It's interesting. People with criminal histories are more willing to tell their stories than those without, or I'm sorry, people with criminal records. So the more than my mugshot participants have been more willing to engage or more readily willing to engage, I think, than people with that have had the luxury to forget. And yet they have had a more difficult time telling their story. And this is just a generalization. You know, there have certainly been people who, with the luxury to forget, who have leapt right in and been very excited about participating. There have been those who have had difficulty recalling what they've done. But just as a generalization, it has been harder to pull stories from people who are participating in the more than my mugshot phase. And I think that part of the reason why is that they are so used to defining themselves by what they're not. They're so used to having to explain their criminal histories that they don't get the opportunity to really discuss who they are outside of that context. And so I hear a lot of stories about how people are no longer engaged in crime, or perhaps who are sober or whatever that might be, but it takes a long time to get people to tell me that they make the best sweet potato pie in the county, or that they grow the best tomatoes, or that they put three of their grandchildren through college. There was one gentleman that I interviewed. It took him 18 minutes to remember that he had been a medic in the U.S. Army. This man had saved lives. If I had done anything like that, I would lead off with that.
If different life could have been, and inviting these types of questions. So I think it's wonderful that you've the work that you've been doing. I wanted to share one last comment from one of our listeners, Smita from Boulder, who wanted to say, Emily, amen, sister. I have loved all that you have shared this morning. Your authenticity and the truth you speak has put in me tears. Thank you.
Oh, Smita, you have me tearing up. Thank you.
And I definitely have to agree with Smith. I'm sure all of us feel the same way. Wanted to just deeply thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.